Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Politics and Polemics, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Magu. I also host my own podcasts, Independent Thought and Freedom, and also a story club, Global Politics and Global Cultures. You can find them on the sidebar of the New Books Network website. Today, my guest is Ian Buruma, author of the book, The Churchill Complex, The Curse of Being Special, From Winston and FDR to Trump and Brexit, published by Penguin, out now in hardcover, audiobook, and on Kindle. Welcome, Mr. Buruma.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's a real pleasure to have you. I mean, you are, you know, an author and public intellectual of some note. You know, it's a decade-long presence. But, you know, there may be some people in our audience who still may not know about your background. So we like to usually start off with the author's, you know, telling our audience a little bit about your background and how you came to this book.
Well, I was born in the Netherlands in 1951, so very much still in the shadow of World War II. My father was Dutch, my mother was British. And so the idea of Churchill and England and the heroism of the war and so on was very much part of my childhood. My grandparents, were the children of immigrants, Jewish, and so they very much felt that Winston Churchill had saved their lives. So I grew up with that notion. I studied Chinese, and at a time when you couldn't really visit China, unless you were an official friend of the people.
What year is that?
That was the very early 70s.
Okay.
And I started watching Japanese films and got interested in Japanese theater, and I moved.
So the Cultural Revolution was
still on.
Yeah.
And so I went to Japan to study cinema and spent 6 years there, and then later spent 7 years in Hong Kong. So Asia is very much part of my life. And after living in London for quite a long time, I moved to New York, where I teach part of the time, one semester a year at Bard College, and the rest of the time I try to write. And I've written on many different topics, many of them to do with China, Japan, Asia, but also Europe, and two novels, and so on and so forth.
Right. So, well, if we get to the title of your book, The Churchill Complex, well, what do you mean by that, and why is it important?
What I mean is that Churchill was a great myth maker, and he created his own myth based on real things, of course. But the myth was that Churchill was a great war hero, especially in 1940, when Britain supposedly stood alone against Europe. Of course, it didn't stand quite alone. It had a huge empire. And Chamberlain in 1938... was the great villain. He was the coward. He appeased Hitler's Germany and so on. And the complex, as it's described in my book, is that every time there was a foreign crisis which called for some kind of intervention or not from the US or Britain, the two ghosts of Churchill and Chamberlain would rear up. And too many presidents and also prime ministers as their junior partners felt that they needed to take Churchill as their model and were terrified of being Chamberlain, which led to a lot of foolish wars, the last of which perhaps had the most far-reaching consequences was the invasion of Iraq. So that's what I mean by the complex. So on the one hand, the United States, seeing itself in Churchill's image, fighting for against dictators all over again, and freedom and democracy and so on, at least rhetorically. And Britain sort of wanting to prolong its finest hour by staying too close to what they call the special relationship with the United States and not and missing the boat time and time again when it could have played a leading role in Europe.
Right, yeah. And there's kind of a weird reversal there, isn't it? Where Churchill was the driving force to get America into the war. Was there a kind of reversal going forward in terms of the United States being the more aggressive one and dragging Britain in? Or would you say Britain still had a sort of leading role? How would you see that?
Well, Britain couldn't really have a leading role for very long after the war because without its empire, Britain was just a large European state and had nothing like the power that it once had or that the United States continued to have. And so it could only play a role as the partner of the U.S. And very often the U.S. wanted Britain to take part in American military enterprises to give it more legitimacy. In the case of the Vietnam War, the prime minister then in Britain, Harold Wilson, couldn't really do that because he knew if he sent troops to Vietnam, he'd lose the left of his party. Mm-hmm. But he had to support the United States, at least in rhetorically, in order to keep the Americans happy. So it depended a little bit on the war. I mean, in some cases, the Americans, Suez in 1956, when the British and the French and the Israelis attacked Nasser's Egypt, it was the United States that had to rein in the British and, in fact, stop the war. So it depended on the circumstances. But yes, usually it was the United States that wanted Britain to take part.
Right. And what's the main argument of the book? Because I know you criticize, some of the, I guess, the myths surrounding it. But if you could just walk us through.
Well, the main argument is not that everything about the Anglo-American or mostly American order set up after World War II was a disaster. If you grew up in Western Europe, you very much benefited from it. It would look different, I think, if you were in South America, for example. But if you were Japanese or Western European, it was a great benefit. But I think the moral of the story in my book is that an hour of glory in history can contain the seeds of future problems. And I think the United States, all through its history, veering from a tendency to isolate itself from the world on the one hand and be a sort of crusader on a mission to spread democracy and freedom through the world on the other, in a way got seduced into trying to repeat World War II over and over and over again whenever there was a dictatorship, and especially when the dictatorship was communist. And in the case of Britain, I think Britain should have, that's my opinion, should have played a leading role in Europe and shaping Europe's institutions rather than always staying aloof until it was often too late. And it sort of scrambled to join the other Europeans, but didn't have very much influence anymore, not the influence it should have had. And I think that also has a lot to do with this wanting to prolong the glory of 1940 when it was no longer really relevant. And I think in the run-up to Brexit and the Brexit campaign, you saw this very clearly because it was full of nostalgic rhetoric about Spitfires and Finest Hour and Dunkirk and all that when we've moved on since then.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. And I think there's a sort of a tension there in what was created by this complex that you've identified. So on the one hand, there's the Anglo-American order, which can be viewed from different perspectives, as you say. But there's that liberal internationalist order of Bretton Woods and NATO, et cetera, et cetera. And then I suppose, well, I guess it's your point of view, whether you see it as a contradiction or not. But then there's that sort of what you might call the neocon, you know, the push to war, the constant push to war. Let's not be a Chamberlain. So like even today, if some, you know, people have a moderate view towards Russia or China, oh, you're an appeaser like Chamberlain. So you have this war machine, this constant, you know, which I suppose you can call the military industrial complex if you want to use those terms. But so you have that, and then you have the liberal international order on the other hand. And this, it seems like a contradiction. But what's your reflection on that?
Well, it's not always a contradiction. Of course, like everything else, it has a longer history. And people often think that hawkishness is something of the right wing, or something Republican. Actually, the contrary is true, that it was usually the liberal side of American politics, the Democrats, who were interested in foreign interventions and spreading democracy. And it was Kennedy and then Johnson who got and kept the Americans in the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. after all. But I think the history really goes back to the 19th century, at least, and to a sort of Protestant missionary spirit of thinking one's own values are universal, and in this case, sort of Anglo-Saxon liberal values, and that the United States in the first place, but Britain also, had a kind of mission to spread this across the world in the way that missionaries would spread Christianity. I think that's somewhere in the background of this. Now, we're living in a strange age at the moment where Donald Trump, for as long as he lasts, gone back to the 1930s and to the American tendency to isolate itself. So is not particularly keen on military adventures abroad. On the other hand, is very hawkish rhetorically towards China in particular, less so in the case of Russia, and is perfectly capable of doing something wild if he feels that his masculinity is challenged or something of that sort. But the military-industrial complex, is it in contradiction to the liberal tradition? Not really. I think that the liberal tradition itself has periodically had a very hawkish face.
Absolutely. I mean, the neocons started off, well, as Trotskyists, and then later into the Democrats, and then into the Republicans, and now sort of back into the Democrats. So that's certainly historically right. Your book is not primarily a history book. It's not so much about Churchill as it really is about the current age and, in a sense, the unraveling of this complex and this order, and it is a somewhat of a lament for that unraveling. Even though, you know, you recognize the contradictions and so forth. Do you want to expand on?
Well, it's a lament in the sense that there was a lot of good in it. I grew up with it. And of course, one always laments the demise of something one grew up with. I mean, I often have to think of the death of Stalin, and there was no country that suffered so much and hated Stalin more than Poland. And yet people were crying in the streets of Warsaw because, you know, they grew up with it. It's as though a bit of yourself is dying. I feel that way a little bit about the Anglo-American order. On the other hand, every order has its natural life. Yeah. And I think that the Pax Americana, the American order, was absolutely essential to get Europe back on its feet, and Japan, and even South Korea. And it allowed these countries to rebuild their economies get wealthy, and so on, while leaving security up to the United States. But that is becoming less and less sustainable. When some of the richest countries in the world are so totally dependent on the US for their security, and US taxpayers are not going to be happy to pay for this forever either, which is something that Donald Trump has exploited in his America First rhetoric.
Yes. And there's something else you've that runs throughout the book as well. As opposed, you know, reflect, if you want to use a different word than lament, sort of reflecting on the end of this system, this order, which is that you critique the myths, the myth of the relationship. And I don't know if it's fair for me to say that you see it as a kind of phony is too hard, maybe a manufactured sort of relationship. Not really as primordial as it's made out to be. Do you want to elaborate?
Well, I don't think it's primordial because there was not very much love lost between the Americans and the British in many periods of their history. I mean, they went to war at one point. But after the war, it has a concrete reality as well as a mythical component. It's true that on the level of intelligence, for example, Britain and the United States have cooperated very closely. Sometimes prime ministers and presidents were personally close. They speak the same language. And so there are affinities, and it's not all based on nonsense. On the other hand, from the point of view of Washington and the United States, Britain has never been as important as the British like to think. And what is special about it is more special to the British than to the Americans, even though most American presidents feel flattered when they can go and horse riding with the Queen in Windsor and that kind of thing. But that's flim-flam. And I think the Americans, really, since the war, have encouraged the British to be a leader in Europe. And so that they could be the bridge between the European continent and the United States. And it's a role that the British have not played terribly well on the whole.
Is there anybody, obviously, you're writing, you've written your book in a, polemical style is not exactly the way I want to describe it, but you're making an argument, definitely. And is there anybody specifically in mind who you might be sort of arguing against, or any body of ideas or something or misconceptions that particularly you're tackling in the book?
Well, I think that the idea of sort of Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism it has not been healthy. I mean, it had its uses, I suppose, during World War II when Winston Churchill became very popular in America, more popular than Britain ever was. And I think because he played up to that image, that self-image of Americans as sort of uniquely free and with a national destiny to spread that freedom and all that kind of thing.
And free-born Englishmen kind of...
That's right.
Yeah.
But I think in most periods after the war, it's held Britain back. I mean, not long after the war, when European institutions were in their infancy, especially the smaller countries in Europe and Germany were very keen for Britain to really lead and shape Europe. The French, of course, were rivals, and under General de Gaulle, the French didn't want Britain to join because they wanted it to be a French show. Mm-hmm. But most Europeans wanted the British to be very much part of it, and the British missed their chance, partly because they saw themselves as victors in World War II and therefore not like other European countries. They're an island, but also because of this nostalgic clinging on to the wartime relationship.
Right. Yeah, I myself coming from Trinidad and Tobago here, and coming from, you know, the former colonial world. I mean, America is a former colony too, but
not, you know, quite in the same way that
exactly
Trinidad.
Precisely. But you know, you've done a lot of work in Asia and so forth. You know that, you know, we have a very sort of mixed and contradictory view sometimes, a sort of love-hate relationship, which I think America also does have this kind of love-hate relationship with Britain. We share that sort of colonial hang-up in a sense. But you would obviously be aware of the critical views of Churchill, let's say particularly, but of course, and also the Anglo-American order after World War II. But I mean, there's one piece who in today's climate, I can't even name the title, but it's Not Counting N-Words by George Orwell. Are you familiar with that essay?
I don't know that essay, no.
Oh, it's an excellent essay where he's criticizing Churchill, he's criticizing the Allies, and their conceit, and the left as well, the hypocrisy of the left in these countries. For their conceit for being, you know, Democrats and liberals, right? They have these huge colonial empires, and so that, you know, so you have that sort of criticism there, and then, you know, more recently people like Shashi Tharoor, who I'm sure you would have
yes.
You're familiar with his work on Churchill sort of reviving and furthering it, quantifying it, so I mean. You're obviously sensitive to these critiques as well.
Yes.
through your writing, and I mean, even someone like Naipaul, who I know you've written on, and My Countrymen, people were surprised in 1990 when he expressed sympathy for the BJP and the RSS,
for
the rising nationalism. And in fact, you know, a lot of people are lamenting, you know, this decline of the Anglo-American liberal international order. But, you know, from a perspective like mine, I and as you intimated earlier when we were speaking, you know, we may not have such a rosy view of that order. How do you... you know, what's your comment on
that? Well, I think, first of all, let's begin with Churchill himself.
Yeah.
Churchill was certainly an imperialist. He thought that British power, which he believed in deeply, depended on the empire, and he wanted to hang on to it as long as possible. He certainly had, even for his time, old-fashioned views on that certain races and peoples were superior to others. At the same time, he was very devoted to parliamentary democracy and so on. Like all historic figures, I think he was a bundle of contradictions. And you can criticize him for some of his views and admire him for others. Roosevelt was very aware of Churchill's imperialism, and one of their finest documents, and I do describe that in a very positive manner in my book, was the Atlantic Charter in 1941. And one of the bones of contention between the two was the notion that all people should have the right to independence. Now, Churchill did not think the Indians or any other colonial subjects should have that right, but Roosevelt did. And I think Nehru, who may have been in prison at the time, I can't remember, but very much admired the Charter and thought this was the way for India to get its independence. And in the end, they fudged it because Roosevelt didn't want to quarrel with Churchill over this. The wartime relationship was too important, or the future alliance, allowed Churchill to interpret it that only countries that were occupied by the Nazis or by Germany should regain their right to independence, and left the empire sort of vague.
Yeah.
So Churchill did have that side to him. There's absolutely no question. When you talk about the love hate in ex-British colonies such as Trinidad, or in the United States. I think there's a subtle difference. I think in recent British colonies and the Caribbean would be an example. Mm-hmm. There is still very much a sense of colonial oppression and the need for independence, and that needed to be fought for. And it's in recent memory; it's fresh. That memory in America is not really fresh at all. I mean, very few people give it any thought. I think in America, the attitude to Britain was in some ways a little bit more like that of continental Europeans. It was largely a matter of class, and that the upper classes on the East Coast admired the sort of the gentlemanly tradition of Britain, the tweed suits, the country clubs, the golf.
But I'd like to interject here that certainly in the former colonies, including Trinidad and Tobago and elsewhere, there's especially where the country may be badly run, there's a huge nostalgia amongst all classes. We wish we were still colonies. We wish, you know, that they, there's tons of people. My Facebook posts today have all sorts of comments saying that because of some criticism of the government.
Yes, but that wouldn't be true in the United States.
Obviously. That's right, exactly. But the upper class and the sort of upper class, you know, loving the British accent, the British culture, and the epitome of anything cultured is British. You know,
this
sort of thing we definitely share in a way that maybe someone from, you know, Holland may not share.
No, they did have that, but I think it's very much a fading infatuation. I mean, I still grew up in that atmosphere in The Hague, and where the upper middle classes played cricket and wore blazers. And
so there's an Anglophilism even in.
Oh, yeah, because and the same was true in Hamburg. It was very true often in coastal cities and the yacht club in Hamburg before the war and after the war, when, you know, Germans would nickname each other Bobby and Mickey and that kind of thing. But I think
no French yacht club would think so, though.
No. Well, even in France. I mean, in France and Italy, the aristocracy often had the style anglaise. And no, it existed in France, too. But that's really a fading memory now. I mean, I don't think that that's very strong any longer. And contemporary Britain, despite Boris Johnson's posturing, really doesn't represent that kind of image anymore.
Yeah. Because, I mean, just as a final reflection on this sort of love-hate thing, it's probably after the Cold War, so let's say in Hollywood, whereas before, the villains used to have Russian accents, and when if you go farther back, they might have even had fezes on their head. But after the Cold War, it's like mainly the villains had British accents.
During the Cold War too, that goes back a long way, and that of course has everything to do with class. Mm-hmm. That Hollywood movies were a popular medium for the masses, and so anything that was associated with the upper class. It was an easy target, and that meant British accents, which were often imitated by the American sort of East Coast elites to a certain extent. And so, but that goes back to the 30s.
Right.
Maybe longer.
Now, one thing I'd like you to comment on too is I find it very interesting that both Trump and, let's say, Boris Johnson, perhaps more Farage, but let's say Boris Johnson, I mean, they're looking to tear down that order that Churchill and Roosevelt had built up. But even that, their partnership in doing so reflects some sort of relationship, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. And what they have in common is that they're exploiting the resentment against elites, and in both countries. Mm-hmm. But of course, since different countries have different histories, that comes out in slightly different ways. I mean, in America, obviously, when class and elite politics, or the politics of resentment, manifest themselves, it always involves race, because of American history. more so than in Britain. I mean, it's not absent in Britain, and as we know, that things like Black Lives Matter and so on immediately have an effect in Britain as well. But of course, the history is somewhat different. Mm-hmm. But in what Farage exploits is the anger against what people regard as the elites. And the elites are associated with, as is true in other parts of Europe, with the EU, with European unification, with immigration, with multiculturalism, and so on and so forth. And so people often say that Brexit was all about immigration and sort of hatred of immigrants and so on. It's true up to a point, but I think it was very largely a question of a backlash against the elite. Yeah. And because the elite was in favor of Europe and immigration, the backlash went against that.
Yeah, I mean, and for coming from the former colonial world, I mean, I see in that movement, you know, very, similar, resentments against, neoliberalism and financial capitalism and the exploitation of the working class and the gutting of manufacturing and deindustrialization and, fighting against this inequality, and lack of a middle class kind of service oriented, where you have the super rich billionaires and the peons at the bottom. And Trump in particular, come out and say how he would attack the FBI and the CIA and say America has blood on its hands and talk about the senseless wars. I mean, that really speaks to the kind of anti-colonial sensibility that was critical of this Anglo-American post-World War II order for a long time. And I found that to be quite striking myself. I don't know whether you're...
Well, it would speak to the anti-colonial sensibility in former colonies.
Yes.
I think in America, of course, it has a very different resonance. And one reason it resonated amongst the lesser educated people, especially in the south of the United States, is that it was the poor who had to fight wars abroad. It was the people who died in Iraq were not, members of the East Coast or West Coast elites who went to universities. They were poor kids on the whole. And so when Trump says enough of this, that was popular amongst a lot of his voters who were among the less privileged citizens of the US. And again, I think he appealed to this sentiment that it was the elites that had gotten America into these conflicts abroad. And people felt they'd had enough of this. I mean, quite rightly. I mean, you can't fault them on that. But it's something, it's one of the many resentments he exploited. And I think that the fact that he clicked his politics of resentment, that they appealed to so many people who could only dream of the kind of wealth that he had or may not actually have had, but he lived as though he had, was that he shared a lot of that seething resentment. And coming from Queens in New York, from a rather louche real estate family, and so on, he knew perfectly well, he was vulgar, he was crass, that older money in New York looked down their noses at him. He never felt accepted. He felt inferior in many ways. And so his loathing of people who he believes consider themselves superior to him clicked with people who had similar resentments against the elites in America.
Mm-hmm. Throughout your book, you go through the history of the relationship, and it's something very interesting to reflect on. And I'd like you to do so, and I'll just point out that I think before Reagan and Thatcher, I don't think there was anything as powerful as FDR and Churchill. Reagan and Thatcher seemed to, really click it again. And then after that, Clinton and Blair, I think, was, you know, had, and it was from the opposite political end in many ways. Well, if you look below the surface, maybe not, but certainly different parties. And then you had the weird Blair-Bush relationship. Obama didn't really seem to have somebody to click with in the same way, mm-hmm. but Trump kind of does with Farage and Johnson. So why don't you take us through these various relationships and the ups and downs and yeah. And it does seem to speak to some, I don't know if you want to use metaphysical, you know, connection, but there is some, you know, something that's going through time, that's going past ideologies of left and right, that's gluing. Maybe it's just the language or everyone's reading each other's work and, but I'm not sure. I'd like to hear you.
Well, I think that if one talks about real personal rapport, of course, friendship between political leaders is easy to exaggerate. I mean, very few of them are real friends. But I think that Macmillan and Kennedy had a real personal rapport, that Kennedy, the younger Kennedy, admired the kind of savoir-faire and wit of Macmillan, and Macmillan admired the youthfulness and dynamism of Kennedy. Reagan and Thatcher, whether they really liked each other personally, I'm not so sure. I think Margaret Thatcher admired the presidency. She admired the United States, and she admired what Reagan stood for ideologically. I don't think she rated him very highly intellectually and got more pleasure out of arguing with Gorbachev than she did with Reagan telling showbiz anecdotes. That was not her thing, really. But they did click ideologically. And again, the wartime nostalgia had a lot to do with it. Neither of them took any direct part in World War II, but both of them had fantasies about Britain and America sort of standing up for liberty against tyranny, which in their time was represented by the Soviet Union. So, and also they felt that that relatively speaking, their countries were in decline, that they were no longer as great as they had been, and tried to revive that in this joint project to fight the tyranny of the Soviet Union. So that was Reagan and Thatcher. Blair and Clinton is interesting because in many ways they were the heirs of Thatcherism. And when Blair's spokesman or advisor famously said, I think it was Mandelson actually, who said, we're intensely relaxed about getting filthy rich. I mean, that was not the language of a socialist normally.
That's right.
But so Blair and Clinton understood one another in this sort of third way, weak social democratic idea. But Blair and Bush, I think, is the more interesting relationship. And Blair has often been called the most American prime minister after the war. And in many ways he was, not only because of this notion of being intensely relaxed with getting filthy rich, which was a sort of an American side to him, but he was also very religious and had a sort of missionary spirit again, which is, and wore his religion on his sleeve, which is much more American or more common in America than it is in Britain. And I think like Bush, he saw the war against Saddam Hussein and the invasion of Iraq almost in messianic terms. And I don't think he did it cynically, joined the Americans in this invasion cynically because he was a lapdog or because he wanted a place at the high table and so on. There was all that. But I think he really did believe in it. And again, in his memoirs, you can see that he was reading Chamberlain's diaries on the eve of the war and told himself that he was not going to make the same blunder, and was very sort of Churchillian in his pretensions, as Margaret Thatcher was. And Reagan kept on comparing Thatcher to Churchill and so on.
Yeah. You know, I have a theory, a historical theory, that America is almost like an alternate universe of Britain, with the continuation of the Puritan revolutions, like Cromwell, mm-hmm. and then discontinued. So it's the sort of Calvinist Republic, fully expressed, as opposed to, you know, bringing back the king.
And so, exactly. Yeah, even more so than Britain. And they carried on that tradition, the Cromwellian tradition, whereas the British in some ways abandoned it.
And from what you're describing there, it came to my mind, because it's kind of like Blair, in a sense, kind of took that, you know, although he was Catholic, but it's this kind of Protestant messianism.
Well, he wasn't Catholic at the time. He was very high Anglican. I think he became a Catholic partly because his wife was.
Yeah.
But even so, I think he represented very much that sort of evangelical Protestant tradition, more than a Catholic one. But as we can see today in the United States, the right wing of Catholicism is almost indistinguishable now from the evangelical Protestants, and they have very similar political views.
Now, another thing I'd like you to maybe elaborate on is you talk about the Churchill complex and, Churchill versus Chamberlain and this dichotomy. But you, you do make an argument in the book that, you know, Chamberlain has been treated unfairly and he's been, you know, painted, unfairly with this brush. I think it's important to elaborate, because it is such a powerful image. It is brought up every time where you're just a Chamberlain and a Pisa. Can you elaborate?
Well, I think in retrospect, you could say certainly in 1940 that Churchill was proved right and Chamberlain was proved wrong. You couldn't make a deal with Hitler and trust his word. I mean, and Churchill was quite right to see that clearly when others preferred not to see it. But I think Chamberlain was in a difficult position. Britain wasn't really ready yet to fight a war. Public opinion may not have been quite ready either, which is not to say that he was right, but there were extenuating circumstances. You could at least understand why he did what he did, and to dismiss it as cowardice and a personal failing is not historically, I think, fair. But that's not to say that, you know, I'd be an ardent defender of Chamberlain against Churchill. I think Churchill's greatness was that in 1940, what you didn't want is the kind of politician that you normally do want in peacetime, who is flexible, who will try and find a diplomatic way out, who will try and compromise and so on. Normally, that's the kind of leadership that you need. But in May 1940, you need a bloody-minded, romantic, slightly bloodthirsty leader who understood that they had to do or die.
Right.
And in normal circumstances, you don't want do or die leaders.
Yeah. Which is why that was Churchill's fate after the war.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you know, throughout the book, I notice both subtly and sometimes just explicitly, as you criticize the kind of, how should I say it, the taken for granted, the assumed affinity of this special relationship between the US and UK. And I suppose, especially, you know, since most listeners to NBN will be American, the majority, so they'll know about, you know, US-Mexico or US-Japan or US-China. But let's say from the UK side, what are some of the other, you know, relationships that you know, that are important to the UK, and how does it compare? Like, for instance, I'm thinking, I mean, you mentioned Russia, there might be some kind of relationship there. I know a lot of oligarchs like to go to London and buy real estate. And the India-UK relationship is very interesting, I find. I'm not sure if Canada or Australia would come up there. Although, you know, someone like Mark Carney, head of the Bank of England, I found that interesting. But are there other relationships that the UK has with other countries that are also very important, but perhaps, not overshadowed by the mythology of the US-UK relationship?
Well, I think in the case of the US, you mentioned Obama earlier, and Obama has no sentimental attachments to Europe or Britain.
That's right.
And I think he's also following other US presidents in recent times who are shifting their attention from Europe to Asia, because of the rise of China, because of the enormous economic importance of Asia and so on. It makes sense. Yeah. From the British point of view, again, class is an element that's often lacking in discussion about these things. Just as it's true that the American upper class, the old East Coast elite, was sometimes Anglophiliac because they sent a sense of style and they felt
culture.
Comfortable in culture. They felt comfortable in gentlemen's clubs and that kind of thing. Well, that elite is gone. But you see the same class element in Britain's relations with other countries. For example, I think that the relation with France is very important. Mm-hmm. And modern, or let's say British nationalism since the 18th century has often been, even though there were strong alliances with France, but often Britain defined itself against France. And the sort of the John Bull image of, and the yeoman of Britain and so on, they were reacting against the upper classes of their day, and the upper classes of their day spoke French and drank fine wines, and were seen by the sort of lower classes, the John Bull class, as foppish.
And like so, the old Normans kind of.
That's right. And so France played that role, and Napoleonic times, of course, they were the enemy, and at other times they weren't. But I think that during World War II, and when you come to Churchill and Roosevelt and so on, I find fascinating the role that de Gaulle played, who Roosevelt couldn't stand him and saw him as a sort of pretentious guy who was much too big for his boots, because after all, what did he represent? I mean, a small section of a defeated country. Churchill, like all upper-class Englishmen who prided himself on speaking bad French, was a bit of a Francophile, and he understood the grandeur of de Gaulle's pretensions. And so Britain's relation with France have never been as one-sided as people often think.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting one. Britain's relations with Germany are also interesting, because I believe that in the first decades after the war, until about the 1990s possibly, as long as that, I think the British were less viscerally anti-German than people who had been under German occupation. So the Dutch were more anti-German, the Poles, of course, and often the French. The British, only the British could have had sitcoms on television which described World War II as a sort of comedy.
Yeah.
And Nazis as comic characters. I mean, no Pole would have seen them as comic characters. That started to change in the 90s. Maybe earlier, actually, it was under Margaret Thatcher that they really began to change. And the British began to realize how far they declined economically and how far Germany had gone ahead and were much richer and more advanced in many ways. And the tone of the right-wing tabloids, the Murdoch press at the time, was a sort of peevishness of, this is unfair. We won the war. Why are these people suddenly doing so much better than us? And so the anti-German, the sort of anti-German hooligan spirit really came quite late. It's a recent phenomenon. And some of the resentment against the EU in Britain amongst Brexiteers is also this resentment of Germany. As one of Margaret Thatcher's minister famously said, you know, the EU is a German racket. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it has been seen. As far as India is concerned, the British often like to take it for granted that the Commonwealth nations will somehow treat Britain outside the EU with a certain sort of friendly deference. And I think that's a complete delusion. I don't think there's any great fondness for the UK in India today. And I think that's one of the many delusions of Brexit.
Yeah. Although it does seem that the British, there's at least a certain section of the British elite really, you know, are close to the Indian elite as well. And then the huge investments from, you know, the Mittals and the, you know, Reliance and these people. I just find it interesting. And, you know, even among the nobles, you know, whatever's left of the nobility in Britain seem to click with the, you know, the old princely families.
Yes, but I think that's all very marginal. And as yeah. as you know yourself, I mean, the sons and daughters of the Indian elite today are more likely to go and study at Harvard and Yale than they are at Oxford or Cambridge. And I don't think that in Modi's circles there is any great Anglophilia, and nor is there very much admiration for Modi in Britain today. So I think, yes, you have sort of nostalgic Indians who read P.G. Woodhouse and sort of crusty old Englishmen who sort of laughing.
They have these celebrity weddings among the super rich and these types of things too, you know, among the British and Indians. I just find that.
There's a little bit of that, but I think that's all very marginal.
Mm-hmm. But so in going toward the conclusion of the book and, you know, concluding of the interview as well, but the U.S.-UK relationship, as I said, you know, it's sort of a reflection on the end of the order. But is that the same thing as the end of the relationship? Because it is interesting that it is, you know, a sort of joint Anglo-American project to dismantle the Anglo-American post-World War II order, in a sense. What do you?
Well, it's all a matter of interests, isn't it? Yeah. And I doubt if many presidents or prime ministers will be completely driven by sentimental motives. And from the American point of view, when it comes to national interest in trade and other matters, the EU will matter much more than a Britain outside the EU. And British interests, even under Boris Johnson, don't necessarily align with those of the United States either. If Trump gets another 4 years and, for example, would want to withdraw from NATO, I cannot imagine even a government under Boris Johnson applauding such a move. And so interests will keep the two sides apart in many respects. But what they have in common is that they're now, both countries have leaders who exploited a similar wave of anti-elite resentment. But that's not very much. And so it seems to me, yes, there will be relations, there'll be a lot of trade, a lot of business, possibly intelligence sharing and so on. But I very much doubt that in the next 20, 30 years, Britain outside the EU will mean a great deal to those who are in power in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, what message would you like to leave your readers with after completing your book?
Well, I think the message, my message would be, if there is a message, I mean, it's always difficult to condense a book in a message, mm-hmm. but it would be that the thing I admire most about what these two countries achieved, apart from defeating Hitler with the help of the Soviet Union, it was the Atlantic Charter. And I think the principles of the Atlantic Charter are still admirable and still useful. And so the spirit of international cooperation, freedom, liberal trade, all that, I think is still important. And I think what one can only hope that even though the Anglo-American order, as it was set up after the war, may not survive in its present form forever. It won't. But you would hope that some of the principles underlying it will have a longer life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
It's been informative and enjoyable. So once again, the book is The Churchill Complex, The Curse of Being Special, From Winston and FDR to Trump and Brexit. And we've been speaking to the author, Ian Baruma. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you also to our listeners. Make sure you sign up for our notifications so you don't miss any new interviews on this channel in the future. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.